You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, March 1st, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor of comparative media studies and director of the Teaching Systems Lab at MIT, author of Failure to Disrupt, Why Technology Alone Can't Transform Education, Justin Reich will be here with us. Meanwhile, on Saturday, the House passes a COVID-19 relief bill, but the $15 minimum wage is DOA on arrival in the Senate. Johnson & Johnson releases its single one-shot vaccine, shipping 4 million doses today, chasing 20 million through March. And 100 million by the summer. And by doses, I mean full vaccinations. One shot. Governor Andrew Cuomo is accused again of workplace sexual harassment. Has to surrender control of the investigation into his behavior to the state's attorney general. Joe Biden to make a Saudi announcement. Expected to say, we won't do anything about the Khashoggi murder. Meanwhile, Biden announces support for unions. Doesn't mention Amazon by name, but goes further than we've seen any sitting president do in generations, maybe ever. Justice Department appeals the Trump judge's ruling against the CDC eviction moratorium. Iran demands good faith promises to return to the bargaining table with the U.S. over the nuke deal. And Virginia fully legalizes cannabis, making it the 14th or 15th state to legalize cannabis. Myanmar security forces fire on protesters, killing 18. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. With me as always, Emma Vigeland. Emma's here, following her.
How are you doing, Sam?
I'm doing great. I notice you're not wearing a your casual Friday coat. That's
no.
Of course because it's Monday.
No, and I'm not usually using my casual Friday cadence.
There you go. That's right.
Or attempts at pop culture references.
There it is. A lot of people still talking about your Fonzie reference. And,
many people are saying, many people.
People are talking about it. And that's what's really important. It's really not important what they say. It's really important that they're talking about it. That's the way that has been my experience in all of this over the years. Great to have you here. Now, Emma, this is a big deal. I mean, I think like we would like to see we would all like to see the, you know, the president of the United States put on his walking shoes, as it were, soft walking shoes, and march with people who are picketing and looking for a union. That, of course, is a reference to what Barack Obama said on the campaign trail back in 2008 in terms of his support for unions. He never did. He never walked those picket lines. He never marched with any union organizers. I don't even know if he ever put on the soft walking shoes. I mean, if he did, it was completely incidental.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously you're talking about the metaphor, but also in terms of in the way that he governed as well.
Yes. And yeah. And exactly. And he we never heard any full throated support from Barack Obama when it came to unions. And recall that when Democrats took the Senate in 2008, one of the things that they had promised was a vote and a passage of card check, which was basically simplified the process in which people could vote for a union, that they could simply just put in a request. And if enough members of a workplace put in a request for a union, you'd get a union. You wouldn't have an extended period of time, which invariably allows employers to deploy. In the case of Amazon, let's say, just take for example, in this attempt to unionize in Alabama, $25 million. And you talked the other day about some of the things they're doing. They literally got the city, because union organizers can't talk to their fellow workers at the Amazon facility, whereas Amazon can basically spend all day, say, hey, today your job is just learning how bad unions are with these mythical, with these myths. Yeah,
captive audience meetings, etc.
Exactly. Yeah. And Amazon actually got the city in Bessemer, Alabama, to change the timing, you were telling us about this, at the stoplights, so that organizers could not go and actually help unionize or organize there. So there's a lot of things that the administration can do in terms of National Labor Relations Board and whatnot. And there's been some very good moves by the Biden administration in that regard. But one of the things that Obama never did was to use the bully pulpit. And one of the things that he said that he appreciated about Ronald Reagan was that very thing. We just never saw him do it. Well, Joe Biden's doing it. Now, Joe Biden could do more. He could go down to Alabama and actually campaign for the union. But this is pretty important stuff, because you know the union is going to use this clip and it's going to help. Here's Joe Biden. We're going to play the full 2 minutes because it's actually a pretty big deal.
I have long said America wasn't built by Wall Street. It was built by the middle class, and unions built the middle class. Unions put power in the hands of workers. They level the playing field. They give you a stronger voice for your health, your safety, higher wages, protections from racial discrimination and sexual harassment. Unions lift up workers, both union and non-union, and especially black and brown workers. I've made it clear. Made it clear when I was running that my administration's policy would be to support unions organizing and the right to collectively bargain. I'm keeping that promise. You should all remember, the National Labor Relations Act didn't just say that unions are allowed to exist. It said that we should encourage unions. So let me be really clear. It's not up to me to decide whether anyone should join a union. But let me be even more clear. It's not up to an employer to decide that either. The choice to join a union is up to the workers, full stop, full stop. Today and over the next few days and weeks, workers in Alabama and all across America are voting on whether to organize a union in their workplace. This is a vitally important choice as America grapples with the deadly pandemic, the economic crisis, and the reckoning on race, what it reveals, the deep disparities that still exist in our country. And there should be no intimidation, no coercion, no threats, no anti-union propaganda. No supervisors should confront employees about their union preferences. You know, every worker should have a free and fair choice to join a union. The law guarantees that choice. And it's your right, not that of an employer. It's your right. No employer can take that right away. So make your voice heard. God bless you all, and may God protect the workers and their families who are trying to figure out how to make it fairly. Thank you.
So yeah, that you mentioned how big of a deal that is. And just in contrasting Joe Biden with Obama in this instance, Jay Carney, who obviously was a part of the Obama administration. He was the press secretary, but he was previously Biden's director of communications. He works for Amazon now. And NPR writes, Jay Carney, senior vice president for global corporate affairs at Amazon, did not respond to an email asking for comment on Biden's remarks there. So Biden fancies himself as a kind of down home, regular Joe union guy and someone who's been sympathetic to unions, even if his legislative record hasn't entirely always reflected that. But that sensibility and that desire to market himself as such is clearly serving the Bessemer, Alabama Amazon union fight well.
I mean, he, you know, like I say, he could go to Alabama and actively campaign.
Could mention them by name. He didn't mention them by name.
But he mentioned Alabama. I mean, and I think, you know, the key there is that he is saying, he's looking right into the camera, more or less, and saying to those Alabama workers that this is the way you get a middle class. This is what builds it. This is what helps with disparities with black and brown people. I mean, that's a in terms of a shareable, you know, endorsement for the idea of unionization. That's a pretty good one. And for the idea that, like, if anybody's messing with your ability to unionize, that's a problem. I think that is, like I say, there can be more done, but that is a pretty good. That's pretty good, and I think you know.
And the strongest union statement from a sitting president since maybe we've seen before Reagan.
Oh, well before. I think, and we should remind people: the vote started 3 weeks ago, February 8th, I believe it was. There are about 6,000 workers there. You don't need a majority of the 6,000. You need a majority of all the people who are going to vote. And again, Alabama, a so-called right to work state, which actually just means that you have a right to not support the union, even when they're negotiating your behalf. So it costs nothing to people who don't want a union. And so I think there's a pretty good chance of this, but we'll dig into this more as the days come on. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Justin Reich. He is a professor of comparative media studies and director of the Teaching Systems Lab at MIT on his new book, Failure to Disrupt, Why Technology Alone Can't Transform Education. Back in a moment. But first, a couple of words from our sponsors today. You know, you don't really think much about your socks. I never did. To be honest with you, I would get those dumpy socks from like the street fairs. Of course, we haven't had one of those in a year, but and I mentioned to Brendan that this sock company Features wanted to you know, advertise on the show, and I'm like, I don't know. And he immediately, his first reaction was like, those are great socks. I'm like, what? What does that even mean? And I gotta say, like, I think about my socks now. Because I got a couple of these pairs. Well, first I got a couple, and then I got a bunch more of Features. And they are socks that actually support your feet with like a anatomically correct design. And they have targeted compression. The compression acts like a hug around the arch of your foot, keeps your sock in place. Sock doesn't fall down, but that to me is almost like secondary. You actually get left and right shaped socks that are labeled, which is helpful. But they make a big difference for me. You know, I do a little bit of working out, but for me, it's mostly like walking. I do a lot of walking and I feel the difference. My feet feel better. These socks are huge with runners. They are huge with golfers. But for me, you know, just walking around, they're incredibly comfortable and helpful. Brendan hasn't stopped singing the praises basically since I started advertising Features about them. They have just a custom like fit. They're durable. They're just exceptional socks. I've never thought about them before. Features has challenged you to try a pair. And if they're not the best socks you've ever worn on or off the golf course or while you're jogging or whatever it is, they'll take them back. They're so confident that you're going to love their socks They've also given listeners of the Majority Report $10 off your first pair of features. Those are F-E-E-T-U-R-E-S. When you go to features.com/majority, that's features, F-E-E-T-U-R-E-S.com/majority for $10 off your first pair of features. Also, this is Emma's new favorite product.
Magic.
I am actually drinking some right now. It is Liquid IV.
Liquid IV. I love Liquid IV. Sorry.
And for me, my drink of choice, in fact, I start with a bottle of it someday. My drink of choice is the Energy Multiplier. It is an absolute game changer. Gives you that extra boost of energy you all need. And of course, it also hydrates you as well. One stick is like drinking two cups of coffee. It's an all-natural alternative to processed energy drinks. And like I say, it gives you a sustained energy boost throughout the day. It's a healthier alternative. They got matcha, premium matcha, and green energy blend. It's delicious. They have this thing they call cellular transport technology. It delivers an optimal ratio of nutrients for more efficient uptake. I drink it throughout this show. It's non-GMO. It's vegan. It's free of gluten. It's free of dairy. It's free of soy. And the company has donated over 10 million servings globally. It's also super easy when you're traveling to take it, keep yourself from getting dehydrated on a plane. It's great for when you've overindulged the night before. Emma's a big fan of, like, what's your favorite flavor on that?
Well, here, I like, this is the passion fruit one, but I think my favorite's probably the acai berry, but I
is that the way you say it? Acai? I've never understood how to say that. But acai, that's one of many things I don't know how.
Yeah. Well, you said matcha, it's matcha, but sure.
Yeah.
And you drink it every day. I see matcha. It. Yeah.
I'm from Massachusetts.
All right. Sure.
Hey, grab your Energy Liquid IV in bulk nationwide at Costco. Or you can get 25% off when you go to liquidiv.com and use the code MajorityRep at checkout. It's 25% off anything when you order, when you use promo code MajorityRep, not Majority Report, MajorityRep at liquidiv.com. Start fueling your adventures today at liquidiv.com, promo code MajorityRep. And lastly, one of my favorite ways to keep up with books that I don't necessarily want to read, but I want some of the key takeaways, you know, particularly like how to's, like how to learn, you know, how to be friendly with people and make friends and stuff like that. That may be revealing too much. Blinkist is for anyone who cares about learning, but doesn't have a lot of time. It takes the key ideas and insights from over 4,000 nonfiction bestsellers in over 27 categories. That's a lot of books. Gathers them together in 15-minute text and audio explainers, or blinks. And you use the blinks to get to a topic quickly. You can find new topics, ones maybe that you're interested in. You want to read the entire book. Maybe it leads you down a path of stuff that you want to study. Blinkist has even teamed up with popular podcasters to create blinks of those podcasts so you can get to the heart of a podcast episode fast. 15 million people are already using Blinkist to broaden their knowledge in 27 of those nonfiction categories: self-improvement, management, mindfulness, nutrition, all that type of stuff. A lot of how-to stuff. For me, like I say, it has two different functions. Books that I feel like I should read, but I don't want to read, but I should have a notion of like what that person's saying, at least broadly speaking, what that book's about. And there's, you know, Blowout from Rachel Maddow. That's one of them. I mean, there's other, like that Rick Wilson book, Everything Trump Touches Dies. I went to get a notion of just like how, what's going on with those never Trumpers? And, you know, it confirmed some of my sort of predispositions that it was just sort of, you know, I don't know, not necessarily dealing with the ideology as much, whatever. That's not the point. The point is, I'm not going to read that full book, but I'm going to get a taste of it. And then the other is like, I don't read to read the prose of somebody who's telling me how to, you know, get better nutrition or to cut down on my, you know, increase my management efficiency. So that's what I use Blinkist for. And I can listen to it or I could read it. And it really just depends on what I'm doing at any given point during the day. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. You go to Blinkist.com/majority report. You start your 7-day free trial. You get 25% off of Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/majority report to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/majority report. And lastly, just got this email from a listener. My grandmother Irma passed away today after a long battle with cancer. She was a longtime listener of the show and a lifelong progressive who volunteered for Bernie at 2016 at the age of 80. We would always talk about all of you and how Sam's impressions were never as good as Michael's and that maybe he should stop trying to keep up with him. Smiley face. She was the mother of five and the grandmother of five, a wonderful cook and the best matriarch you could hope for. We will miss her terribly, and we're hoping we can get a shofar for her. We know that would make her happy wherever she is. I am happy to do that. This is for you, Irma. And thank you, Dom. Okay. Want to welcome to the show Justin Reich. He is a professor of comparative media studies and director of the Teaching Systems Lab at MIT. He's also the author of a new book, Failure to Disrupt, Why Technology Alone Can't Transform Education. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thanks,
and that background, that's the cover of your book, is it not?
Pretty snazzy, right? You got to have that paid placement to get on.
That's well done.
Well, I am broadly really interested in education and followed the education reform movement over the past decade and a half, which seems to be wrapping up, and the big controversies of the MOOCs, which maybe we want to remind people because I'm a little bit older than I think a lot of the people listening. And of course, I wanted to also talk to you. This is a book that you wrote for the most part before COVID. Maybe all before COVID, but
I edited the page proofs on March 24th. So just as schools were closing down, I was writing the prologue. And actually, it was quite sort of frightening to be editing a book about education technology right on the cusp of the pandemic, this world-changing event, thinking, wow, is all the stuff in this book going to seem just terribly out of date or wrong 6 months from now? And I remember my editors and friends and I going through the whole book right before sending it back in, being like, are things really going to change? We thought, nope, you know, actually the arguments that we're making in here are probably going to stand up sort of despite all the changes ahead. And so far, I don't think there's anything terribly embarrassing or made newly embarrassing in the book by the pandemic.
No, and I think a lot of the things that you the points that you make in the book are actually been borne out. I mean, I'm speaking as a parent, you know, who is dealing with this. And there was a couple of points I want to get to that I think were really spot on. And forgive me if I ask for personal advice at one point.
We'll do it all.
But let's start with the idea. Just I guess broadly speaking, and maybe you can maybe just touch a little bit on what MOOCs are and what they were and what the promise of them supposedly was, because this was happening in 2012. Everybody who had a TED talk was talking about this. It was bound up in the ideology of educational reform, in part because the Gates Foundation was so so much a force behind that. We should just say the RAND Corporation was hired by the Gates Foundation about 2 years ago, I think it was now, to do an assessment on their whole approach to education reform. And their own assessment said, nope, we failed. We shouldn't have done any of this, basically. I mean, that's a summary. But take it from there.
Sure. So in 2011, there were two faculty members from Stanford who sent an email message to a listserv of the IEEE, which is like electrical engineers and computer scientists, and said, hey, we're going to have a new free course on artificial intelligence. It was going to be taught by Peter Norvig and Sebastian Thrun, who both had associations with Google and with Stanford. And they were expecting a few hundred, maybe a couple thousand people to sign up, and 100,000 people signed up for the course. And that sort of struck the computer science community like a lightning bolt. Hey, there's a ton of demand for these ideas. Now, online learning has been going on, you know, since we've had networks. I mean, to some extent, we've had computer assisted learning since we built computers the size of your living room. And so at a lot of institutions, there were organizations that were ready to jump on this opportunity. So Stanford, MIT, Harvard, relatively quickly after this course, started various approaches to creating massive open online courses, which is what MOOC stands for. And the idea was we would take the very best instructors in topics, have them put their lectures on videos, put practice problems in these sort of auto-graded formats, and make this freely available to people around the world, maybe with a small cost if you want to have a certification sort of verified and associated with courses that you finished successfully. And there was a great deal of hope that this would democratize education, you know, that people all around the world who didn't have access to elite higher education would now be able to take, you know, the same introduction to AI course that Peter Norvig and Sebastian Thrun were teaching at Stanford, and, you know, all kinds of other subjects and from all kinds of other institutions. And to some extent, MOOCs have been enormously successful in the sense that there are millions of people who've signed up for them. They've seen a huge surge in enrollment during the COVID-19 pandemic. But they had also promised to dramatically reform higher education. They had promised that they would create a new science of learning. They had promised that they would democratize education. And they haven't really done any of those things. You know, education technologists often hope that new technologies will have a disruptive effect on education landscapes, but they often actually get domesticated by existing educational systems. So sort of the educational firmament kind of looked at MOOCs and said, like, you guys are okay, you fit over there. They're actually really good at helping already educated, already affluent people earn a second master's degree, which in some cases is a perfectly reasonable thing to help folks do. But they haven't had the profound sweeping effects that their initial supporters hoped they would.
I mean, let's talk about and that's one of the, I mean, I guess one of the myths of was that is the myth, are the myths that we have labored under, or at least some in the technology industry, the idea that this technology can do that. I mean, when you look at why, and I want to also turn to K-12, but why technology has failed to do the things that it supposedly could do. Is it just a function of the education system is it's too hard to absorb these things? Or is it that there's also some things that you simply, that the projections of what the technology can do aren't just they're a fallacy in and of themselves. It's not just that they can't be integrated because of the existing system. It's that they can't do the things that we suppose or that the technologists think they can.
It's a combination of both, I think. Now, certainly pronouncements that technology is about to change educational systems are as old as our signals technologies. So in 1913, Thomas Edison told folks that we were about 10 years away from having film strips completely take over textbooks in classrooms. And then in 1923, he gave another talk in front of Congress and he said, we're about 20 years away from film strips completely replacing textbooks in classrooms. So this is like a very old argument in education that technology can create these kinds of sweeping reforms. And why doesn't it? Well, one reason is that our education systems are enormously complex and they balance this incredible array of competing incentives and factors. We ask our educational systems to teach kids how to conjugate Spanish verbs, factor polynomials, tie their shoes, be patriotic, critique the government, not have sex. But if you do have sex, to do it in certain ways. I mean, all of these things are wrapped up in our goals for educational systems. And so when you try to change educational systems systems a lot. If you sort of pull really hard on one part of that complex web, there's all kinds of other parts of the web that go, no, you're screwing up my bit. Like that might work really well for high school math or for kindergartners, but it doesn't work well for middle school science or these other goals that we have. So I think that's part of the conservatism. And then I think, you know, education technologists also tend to view their tools as sweeping, or like Swiss Army knives that can do anything, or bulldozers that'll sweep away the past. But actually the technologies we build are very specific. They're good at very particular things. We have some like adaptive tutoring tools that work pretty well in math. And they work well in math because we can build auto graders that can evaluate human performance in math. We don't have very good auto graders that work in most parts of reading or literature or social studies or science. So we like built this thing, which is actually pretty good in this one space. But unfortunately, education technologists have a tendency to talk about these things as they're about to sweep away the past. If you were going to defend education technologists, particularly circa like 2007, 2008, 2011, you might say something like, at the time, there were a lot of sectors of society that were being transformed by technology. The word friend meant something different. The way we form relationships have changed. Journalism has profoundly changed. Retail has undergone this profound transformation. It maybe wasn't totally crazy to say, look at all of these tools. Look at all the new kinds of educational experiences that we can offer at wide scale for free. Won't this transform education just like these other sectors in society are being transformed? But it turns out that education, for a variety of reasons, is better at domesticating technologies than it is at being disrupted.
Well, I'm curious how the push for charter schools has played into this as well, right? Because that's an era of it kind of dovetails with a push for privatization of certain things, and also, you know, new flashy technology that's being brought into education. Did you find in your research that there was any connection there?
Sure. So one group of people that supports charter schools are free market reformers who think that we could improve educational systems if we, instead of giving money to local school boards, if we gave it to children and their families with the provision that they spend it on educational functions. In fact, some of those same folks then looking at new educational technologies have said, oh, wow, you know, before we thought that if we gave kids these vouchers, they would use it to spend the money on charter schools, you know, as one kind of whole package. But now, like, you know, you could buy your math from Khan Academy, you could buy your Spanish from Rosetta Stone, you could buy your health ed class from the local district. You know, there are folks who sort of imagined kind of a fragmenting of educational experiences. But it's important to say that, like, there are lots of folks who find that vision abhorrent, who are also really excited about education technology. They're excited about education technology because young people don't have the opportunity to pursue all of their interests inside schools. But virtually anything you're interested in, you can pursue online. So folks with like very progressive sort of whole child views of education also can get excited about education technology. It was sort of one of the weird things in 2010, 2011 in the K-12 system, people got really enthusiastic about this idea of personalization in education. And, you know, and you heard sort of free market charter school folks being really in favor of personalization. You heard these like far left sort of John Dewey, Paulo Freire kind of folks being really enthusiastic about personalization. Be like, you all can't possibly mean the same things by this word, because if you disagree about everything else, it's very unlikely that you agree about this.
Well, so what is it, the dynamic? So if it is the case that technology can revolutionize or seriously change the dynamics in so many different aspects of our life and in so many different sectors. What is it that makes it so hard to deal with education? And I guess I'm also thinking, like, there is to have it, be, you know, that part of the motivation for the technology, and, you know, and I think, like, you do, like, raise the issue that some of these people are, you know, they're out to make a buck and they're looking to create a market. And when you create a market in education, it has to have widespread adoption. And on some level, that is that just that a concept is antithetical to the notion of being an educator.
There are certainly tensions, although educational systems have deeply seated partnerships with the private sector. We buy textbooks. There's good research that suggests that like really well-designed textbooks support learning better for most kids and most teachers than teachers just like grabbing their own random stuff off the internet. That's a bit of a, you know, controversial topic, as you might imagine. But there's all kinds of ways that we use the private sector to support the work in schools. But I think there are a few errors of thinking that education technologists have. One I mentioned, which is that they describe their tools as sweeping when they're actually quite narrow. Another thing that I described is that education is just immensely complex, and it's very hard to build toolkits that are really powerful across all different kinds of sectors, all different parts of education. There's a challenge in my book that I called the curse of the familiar, which is that there's some technologists that make tools that sort of digitize existing practices in schools. Like there's a company founded by an MIT dropout, great young man called Quizlet. And Quizlet helps students and teachers make flashcards. If we got together a whole group of educational experts from across the political spectrum and asked them, what does the education system really need to make a breakthrough in the 21st century? There would be no one who raised their hand and said, there's a real dearth of flashcards out there that we've got to tackle in American schools or global schools. But Quizlet is used by something like half of all high school students every month or something insane like
that. I love Quizlet. I use Quizlet in college.
Use Quizlet in college, use Quizlet all the time. And it probably helped you.
It probably did.
Helped you do some studying. It also probably didn't really change your relationship with your peers. It didn't change your relationship with the curriculum. It didn't change your relationship with your teacher. It digitized a practice in schools that was like a little bit better and a little bit more efficient. Now there are other, and those kinds of tools can get widely adopted, and they tend to like help a little bit, but not really change education very much. There are other things that propose like big sweeping changes in the way that we do teaching and learning. One that many of your listeners might know is the Scratch programming language developed by my colleagues at MIT, Mitch Resnick and his team, that proposes a really different way of thinking about computational creativity, digital arts, computer programming, and a lot of schools, when they first adopt this tool, they're just confused by it. It's this sort of open-ended, exploratory, student-driven learning environment. And a lot of people don't know what to do with it. So there's this tension where you can build things that are sort of easily adopted by the system and don't change it very much. Or you can build these things with sort of really bold, innovative pedagogies built into it. And then it's just hard for teachers and students to figure out what to do with those tools. So the challenge, you know, which folks like Scratch are working on, is saying, how do you build something that we can slide into the existing systems and people will go, oh, I can figure that out. That's sort of familiar, but then can lead us to sort of more interesting, more ambitious places.
And this is all part in the second half of your book about what you call more or less intractable dilemmas.
Intractable dilemmas. We try to keep a hopeful presentation for it.
Could
it haven't
so
really been
far,
solved yet, but
so
we're working
far
on
intractable
it.
Dilemmas. Yep. Tell us about the assessment. I mean, one of the things that you assessment and data. These are dilemmas and things that you find a little bit problematic. Tell us about that.
Sure. So our educational system is driven in many ways by our assessment system. We prepare students for tests that act as gatekeeping experiences. If you want to build automated learning experiences, one of the things you often want to have in those learning experiences is some kind of feedback for learners. You want to be able to say, hey, Emma, you did that pretty well, or hey, Emma, you don't get it yet. And in order to be able to do that, we need to develop computer programs that can assess human performance. We've been working on this for 60 years. There was a computing in lots of ways, but one was a computing system developed at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign called the Plato system. And it had, you know, what is probably the first kind of computer language for educational software was called Tutor. And the way that you created questions and answers in Tutors is that you'd program a question like, what is 2 + 3? And then you would program a bank of answers and you'd type the number 5 and then you'd enter 5 spelled F-I-V-E. And 5 spelled capital F-I-V-E and 5 spelled F-I-V, you know, in case somebody misspelled it. If someone typed one of those correct answers, then the computer system would go, yep, okay, go on to the next problem, or nope. do some remediation about single digit addition. So this is something we've been working on for 60 years, and it basically depends on pattern matching. Somebody has to make a bank of answers, and somebody has to make a bank of things that are questions. And does the student put in an answer which aligns with the answer bank? We still basically do that 60 years later. There's sort of some more sophisticated ways we can do that. For instance, there are physics simulators where the laws of electricity are extremely well understood, and we can write a bunch of scripts and computer programs that could describe every possible way you might connect a simulated circuit and resistor and transistor and battery and light. And we can always tell you whether or not you've built this virtual circuit in the right way or the wrong way. But there's lots of stuff that we do where right answers are not obvious and clear. Pretty much any time we ask students to articulate themselves in natural language, in spoken language or in the written word, and especially when we ask them to reason from evidence, when we ask them, to take a body of evidence and say, make some series of claims based on that. That's like the main thing we do in all of the subjects in education, K through 20. And we don't have very good auto graders for that kind of work. And it's not because people are dumb or we haven't invested enough in them or they're not the right people working on it. It's just an immensely difficult problem. So what that means is that we have pretty cool auto grading tools, but they only work in a few areas. They work great in math. They work okay in elementary language learning for folks who use Duolingo or Babbel or things like that. Because computer programmers are really interested in this stuff, we have a bunch of tools like this in computer science for learning computer programming. But we don't have tools that work in many, many parts of our curriculum. And arguably, we don't, the most important things we want people to do is the stuff that computers can't do, is complex communication, is creative thinking. And we don't have very good auto graders for that.
And, I should just say, aside from my experience of that as a parent with my children, that is a big issue in the context of policing online content that we see. When I get a notice from YouTube that we're demonetizing this video, it's because they don't expend the money to have an individual actually watch the show and assess that, hey, when we're bringing up this issue with this fascist, we're not promoting it, we're critiquing it. And their algorithm picks up the letters, the words, whatever, and says this should be demonetized. And then when they go back and actually take a second look at it, they're only just seeing if the algorithm was accurate in finding the words, as opposed to making an assessment like, hey, wait a second. If the idea is that we don't want to promote fascism, for example, this is clearly not promoting fascism. They never get to that point. And that dilemma seems to be, maybe not intractable, but pretty intractable.
It's certainly hard. There's a lot of people trying to make artificial intelligence, allow computers to do thinking like humans can. And in some domains where there are lots of rules and lots of clarity to begin with, these tools can be pretty good, which is why, from now on, you will never beat the best chess playing computer at chess, because that's a domain in which, there's a grid and there's a bunch of pieces and everything's really well defined. And we can just make computers that are better than the best human. But in lots of things, we don't know how to do that. And, many of those things are the things we actually care most about in the education system for people to thrive in the future ahead of us.
And data collection. I was not aware of these sort of proctoring software. That is a little bit scary, particularly, not just in the context of education, although it's problematic, but eventually it's going to migrate somewhere.
Well, it has migrated, so many people might be familiar now with just about everybody taking a test remotely is being asked to have their tests not evaluated, but monitored by these proctoring companies, which use a combination of artificial intelligence and human beings watching them to be able to, try to prevent cheating on these tests. People have noted all kinds of very serious problems with them, like a lot of things, they don't recognize dark skin. So you have these young people who are trying to get ready to take their, introductory biology test, and they have to spend an hour beforehand setting up the lighting in their room to blast their faces until the AI can recognize them. There was a story of a woman who had an eye twitch, a tick, And the tick just made a lot of motion and the system like flagged it as potential cheating. And so, you know, this person now has to spend a bunch of time sort of convincing her professors and her, any human observing her take a test would be like, oh, that's just, you know, the nice student in our class who has a facial tick. And these systems really, they're built on the same technological foundations as malware. We force students to install them on their computers, and require them to maintain them on, you know, and have some capacity to restrict what's happening on the computer and so forth. What we should be doing as educational systems is not treating all of our students like potential cheaters, and subjecting them to these forms of surveillance during these, you know, sort of gatekeeping experiences, especially when our tools have these sort of embedded anti-Black kind of other kinds of unfair biases built within them. But instead thinking about, you know, assessment systems, how do we evaluate students in a way, you know, maybe that's not cheatable. How do we ask students to, you know, make new connections to solve new kinds of problems that haven't been solved before? It's conceptually, it's actually not that hard to do that. It's just expensive. It's a lot cheaper to make tests that, you know, have very similar answers year to year. And then you sort of police people against them.
Well, I mean, that's part of that to me seems like a problematic across the board, is that it's not just expensive. It's less profitable ultimately. And that is problematic. All right. So let's pull back a little bit and give me your broad assessment of our educational system, sort of, I guess, you know, pre-pandemic, but also I think much of the problems that existed pre-pandemic have been heightened and clarified in some respects through the pandemic. And give me your assessment of those.
So the most significant issue we have in our educational system is that we allot resources based on people's ability to pay property taxes and to purchase properties in certain zip codes. Every state makes some effort to alleviate that with middling success. And as a result, we give more opportunities and better learning experiences to some students than to others. And so our educational system, which is supposed to help everyone, you know, start life on a relatively equal footing, exacerbates inequalities. We saw that the pandemic both revealed and accentuated those inequalities. It was like the sort of ocean pulling back before a tidal wave, being like, look at the extraordinary inequalities on a surface floor. And then they just got much, much worse. However, it's important to note that even a system which has all kinds of problems, the people operating and maintaining that system are extraordinary. I think what classroom educators, what school leaders have accomplished during this pandemic is unbelievable. I mean, you know, the society basically said, can you please, you know, previously you just used to run in-person schools. Can you please operate three simultaneous systems, some that will allow people in person, some that will allow people at a distance, and some that will allow some kind of combination? Will you do it with no training, with no additional resources to teachers, with very few, if any, additional resources to school systems? And the way it has worked is that teachers and school leaders and school staff are working unbelievably hard around the clock for months and months and months to make that possible. You know, and as much as we've heard about very substantial complaints by some folks that schools haven't opened fast enough, or they haven't done this thing in the right way, or this other thing the right way, you know, recent surveying suggests that as many as 75% of parents have their children in a form of schooling that they are happy with. And then of the remaining 25%, about 15% wish they could have some more in-person school, and about 10% wish they could have less in-person school. I don't know any other system in the pandemic which has made that many of its constituents happy and has evenly split the unhappy people along the sort of two possible options. So there's all, you know, the signature problem with our education system is that it generates this inequality, it perpetuates this inequality, and we ask of the education system too much to repair that. And so during the pandemic, folks have said, why aren't the schools providing more technology? Why aren't the schools making sure that there's more internet? Why aren't the schools feeding people enough? Why aren't the schools addressing addressing housing issues? Why aren't they doing mental health screening? Why aren't they keeping kids safe? We don't give our schools enough funding to maintain soap in the buildings during normal times. I hope, you know, one of the things that I hope that comes out of this, whether people listening to your show sort of got their preferred form of schooling or not, is that, you know, for millions of kids every year don't get a form of schooling that's adequate for what their children deserve. And we should all be working together, but not just putting it on schools to fix these issues. You know, schools are not supply chain experts. It's not up to schools to like run broadband cable up the hollers of rural villages. We need to have a society-wide effort at trying to provide, you know, right now schools are our social welfare system for children and their families. And we should make it so that there's a whole social welfare system for children and their families. And schools can just focus on the learning part of that.
Have we learned what, I mean, what have, aside from sort of exacerbating those inequalities and, you know, making them clearer, I think, you know, there's certainly nothing you said about the way that we provide resources. I think, you know, people who work in that field didn't know beforehand, but did we learn something too about what, about learning? Are we learning something about learning given this sort of this, I guess, natural, this, you know, this experiment essentially where, you know, building in the idea of like, we didn't have a lot of time to ramp up for this. You know, if you were actually going to do the experiment, you might take a little bit more, you might start really, you know, not at 60 miles an hour, you might sort of ramp up, but even given that, have we learned something about what it takes to learn? And I'm thinking specifically, you know, K through 12, yeah. or, you know, younger, if we had the opportunity.
So some things that we've learned are sort of just reinforcements. We've known for a long time, for instance, that people do an extraordinary job learning about things they really care about online. I bet almost everyone listening or watching to this, you know, they go online to see hair and makeup tutorials, how to beat levels in a video game, how to fix their snow thrower, you know, whatever it is. All of us learn stuff online easily, naturally, successfully, without a lot of difficulty. Teenagers do that too. They teach themselves to code, to make music videos, all kinds of stuff. When you try to teach people stuff that they don't really want to learn, when you try to do, you know, online learning works really well. Online schooling is really hard. It's hard because physical places and physical teachers have all kinds of ways of supporting our motivation that are hard to do at a distance. So that's kind of a reinforcement. Now, a kind of amazing thing that we've seen during the pandemic is 3.5 million K-12 teachers, most of whom didn't know that much about teaching and learning at a distance beforehand, have made extraordinary progress. And I think, you know, I hope parents looking back this March to a year ago March find, you know, that what we're doing system-wide, I'm sure there are pockets where it's still a real struggle, but in lots of places, it's just much more successful than it was before. Interestingly, not with any breakthrough ideas. I mean, I talk to all kinds of people, journalists, school leaders, people in other countries, and I always ask, is there a place that you could point me to that has really figured this out, that has like come up with some remote hybrid learning system that's really working? And no one says yes. Instead, what teachers have done is they've sanded down like 1,000 rough edges, sort of one rough edge a day, being like, ah, that wasn't working as well before. Let's make this a little bit. I don't know if you remember the stories of teachers putting stickers on their faces. People were having difficulty getting student motivation. And so they told their students, everyone who participates in class, if you're a new voice, I'll put a sticker on my face. And so then by the end of class, everyone's talked and the teacher has stickers all over their faces and like hilarity and learning ensues. You know, that's funny to most people. To me, as sort of a learning scientist, that's this like really interesting moment of innovation where teachers say, oh, we have this shortcoming around student motivation. Let's try a different series of practices. You know, that practice probably didn't work more than like a week or something like that. Right. And then the novelty wears off. But it's one of these like little edges sanded down. You know, one, here's a sad fact. This may very well not be the only pandemic that our young students live through during their lifetime. And as we've seen from the freezing in Texas, from the fires in California, because of the climate emergency that we're in, we are going to face a long future with much more interrupted schooling than happened in the era that the three of us grew up in. And so sadly, this pandemic is a trial run to help develop school systems that are going to have to be more resilient and more capable of operating through interruptions, which will become more frequent in the future. So there's a lot that we've learned. There's a lot that we still need to do. We need to figure out how we make broadband universal. We need to treat it as a utility rather than a luxury good. We need to think about what, you know, if we build really robust social welfare systems for children and their families in regular times, then those systems will stand up better and take care of kids and their families better, you know, in whatever next parts of the climate emergency will come ahead. So a lot of important learning has happened, you know, mostly led by a pretty extraordinary profession of teachers who've put in an enormous amount of work over the last year to do that learning, you know, without any extra pay,
right,
working more hours, trying to take care of their own two kids under feet. It's been really a privilege to be able to support them.
Yeah, that's been my experience with our teachers. It's been amazing to see what they do. But that point about motivation is fascinating, because that really seems to be the determinant. I mean, that is that a function of, like, just you're in a physicality, you're in a separate space, and so your mind just says, like, this is the time I've got to apply myself, and or there's
all kinds of, you know, my local elementary school teacher said there are 500 or 1,000 things that our teachers do every day in the classroom that we're just realizing that they do, and none of them work over Zoom. Right. Imagine you're a third grader in a classroom and you're doing something and you lose interest and you pick your head up. And you look around and everyone else in that room is doing what they're supposed to do. And then you make eye contact with your teacher, and the teacher, like, gives you a friendly but kind of "what are you doing" sort of look. And then you're like, I think I'll pick up my pen and keep working on this kind of boring thing that I'm supposed to do. And you just go about your life. If you're a third grader sitting at home, there's, like, a new puppy in the corner, and there's a refrigerator full of snacks, and this computer you're looking at has, like, 18 more interesting programs than the one you're looking at now. Like, the whole edifice of school is designed to, like, gently, you know, hopefully gently and humanely, not always, but in a lot of places, gently and humanely help you maintain your focus on activities that, like, are not your first choice. You know, we don't know how to replicate all of those structures over online learning. And we know that a relatively small proportion of the population is good at doing this intuitively. You know, most people are not very good at self-regulating their own online learning. And those who are tend to be those who had a successful apprenticeship in the formal educational system. People become good at self-regulated independent online learning when they've had a bunch of years of really good schooling.
So that raises two questions. One, where did you hide the camera in my apartment that you can see what my son is doing? And you got it wrong. It was cat, not dog.
Yep.
And what can parents do? I mean, if you were to give, like, one set of advice for parents now, you know, hopefully, knock on wood, by September, this is not an issue, but we still have, you know, 5 months, 4 months in some instances. What would you recommend to enhance that element of it, or any element?
I would start, for parents and teachers, I would encourage you to bring what we in the profession call the asset framing towards young people. It can be very easy to be drawn into all the things that aren't working and all the ways that our kids are not learning this year what they might have learned in previous years. But I think a great place to start is to say, what are all the things that young people can do after the last year that no other generation of American students has been able to do? I mean, self-regulated learning is hard, and kids, you know, certainly aren't mastering it, but they've made enormous progress, in my sense, which is something that we can build on in the future. Young people know more about technology-mediated learning, as imperfect as it is, than any other previous generation. Where have there been successes that we can build on and celebrate? How can you maintain really good communication with your teachers? Teachers are totally overwhelmed, but they really do want to know how each of their students is doing and how they can help them. So being in polite polite, respectful dialogue with teachers, which can include describing all of the things that aren't working and all the things in which your students need help. And for some of them, your teachers may shrug their shoulders and say, I know it kills me every day. It kills me, but I don't know how to fix that thing. But I think it's still important to say all of those things out loud. You know, there's going to be a huge debate coming up about how we spend our summers, particularly if there's, you know, big additional funding coming in from the federal government to support schools, and whether we should try to have a summer of intensive tutoring to make up for the, you know, so-called learning loss, which has been missed this year, or whether we think, you know, what kids actually need is time outside and playing with peers and getting recharged and feeling better about themselves. You know, I think, you know, hopefully it helps some folks to try to look towards the summer and say, hey, you know, we're going to have a chance to do some kind of reset. And hopefully there will be more options available. You know, there will certainly be more options available to the extent that we organize and make our voices heard as parents and as advocates for children and their families, to say it's really important. Municipalities, states, the federal government, like, what can we do to have kids have a really fabulous summer? You know, which might just be doing awesome stuff. It might have some academic components to it. And then, you know, I think maintaining dialogue with your children too, trying to set each week some kind of realistic goal. You know, what's one thing that hasn't been going well or didn't go well last week? What's one thing that we can do a little bit better this week? You know, and I think if kids know that we love them, that we support them, that their educational journey is a long journey. And for, you know, there are plenty of kids who are just totally fed up, super frustrated right now. And we have to somehow build systems that say to all of those kids, you know, whenever we can get back into a little better order and whenever you're ready to dive back into this, like, there's, you know, there's no off ramp to education. There's always, or no permanent off ramp. There's always a chance back on. You know, if this didn't click for you this year, like there's a new year coming up. You know, there are a lot of kids who are going to drop out of high school, who are not going to apply to high school. You know, how do you get back into a GED track? How do we get you into community college? You know, being optimistic about the extraordinary capacity of young people.
Well, Justin Reich, the book is Failure to Disrupt: Why Technology Alone Can't Transform Education. Thanks so much. Really appreciate it. It's really fascinating stuff. And hopefully we get some, and I think you've outlined some of at least the benefit out of this really miserable, largely miserable experience over the past year. But thank you so much.
Thanks, Sam. Thanks, Emma. Take care.
Thanks so much.
And take a quick break. We'll be right back. Wrap things up. Bottom line is, I don't think I've ever spoken to an educator over the past 10 years on this program. And I have spoken to literally dozens. And to a person, they will talk about our funding mechanism for education in this country, how problematic it is tied into property taxes, because invariably, those same education experts, educators, will say, I can tell you what the educational outcomes are if you tell me what the area code of where the school or the education system is. And I will tell you what the outcomes are, because it is that predetermined by wealth and money. And of course, we have that same problem in the context of COVID. But, you know, I mean, hopefully there'll be some things that come out of this. But when you begin to realize the importance of having teachers fully resourced and a building that is fully resourced in terms of being able to direct children in that way, you realize why teachers themselves are so important and why teachers unions are important too, because they're the ones who are sort of advocating to make sure that teachers get those things to the extent that we can. I mean, we really do need to change the funding system, though.
Oh, 100%. I mean, that's it's so antiquated and outdated, and it's been documented for a very long time that this is a primary issue in terms of our education disparity. I mean, it's just like, for a lot of people, education is such a dry topic, and having it dealt with on a federal level is such a Herculean task. So, you know, we're many decades behind the eight ball in that area.
Yeah, we desperately need to have more federal funding. And frankly, I mean, I would federalize all of it. And that way, you know, and the schools will get the funding in the way that we deal with any other type of social services that are it's a function of, you know, the numbers of people in there and the need. But hope springs eternal, as it were. We will talk more about this, maybe, I don't know, and other issues tomorrow. Tomorrow we're going to be focusing on healthcare and how we are, where we are nationally in terms of healthcare, and what went wrong, what went right, what could go right in the future. We will talk about that tomorrow. Emma, we'll see you then. Actually, I lied. Emma, we're going to see you now.
Hello.
We're going to head into the fun half in just a moment. Remember, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show. You get it free of commercials. Cut out those commercials. We're not going to cut out the letter about Irma, though. All right, Matt?
No. That was beautiful.
And you support this program, and then you get the extra content in the fun half every day. jointhemajorityreport.com. Yeah, I mean, it is, there have been people who've been listening to this show from back in the Air America days. And, you know, and we've, over the years, we've lost some fairly well-known, you know, members of the listening community. It's sad, but it's also, you know, it's like losing friends on some level. You know, people have been with you for 10, 15 years listening to the show, and,
I always marvel at the audience that you've cultivated.
We have a great audience here. We definitely, do, without a doubt. Also, a reminder, that audience loves justcoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. And don't forget the AM Quickie. You can find the AM Quickie at amquickie.com. You can get a headline every morning in your inbox. We're getting it out earlier and earlier. I'm shocked. No matter when my son wakes me up.
You're getting it out more quickly?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, more
don't forget to like the stream. Remember, we got to help you. Don't forget to like the stream.
Like the stream. Jamie, what's on the Antifada this week?
Well, this week on the Antifada, I'm very excited about this episode. We are doing an episode on the Fred Hampton movie that just came out, Judas and the Black Messiah. And I'm a tiny bit superstitious, so I'm not going to say who the guests are because we're recording it later today. And, you know, I don't want one of them to be struck down with a lightning bolt or something. But I'm very excited about the guests that we have on. And that's out Wednesday, patreon.com/theantifada. Also, we're streaming on Twitch 3 nights a week, twitch.tv/theantifada. Sean plays video games on Monday. We got our full crew show. Forever's going to start tonight on Wednesday. We got Pop Culture Party on Friday and Antifada Ladies Night on Thursday, hosted by yours truly. So a lot of stuff to watch, folks.
A lot going on Twitch. Matt, what's going on in your neck of the woods?
Yeah, on Left Reckoning last week, Thursday, I had an interview with one of my favorite historians, Peter Lindbaugh, on his book, Red Round Globe Hot Burning. It's about the enclosure of the commons and how that relates to resistance movements from basically the Haitian Revolution to Dakota Access Pipeline, and how all this is tied to enclosure and the sad triumph of capitalism. So check that out. I was I'm a little bit nervous during it. So if you want to see me a little bit nervous interviewing somebody I really respect, check that out at the Left Reckoning YouTube page.
I'm interested in seeing what that looks like.
I would never admit that. I'm like, my ego's too big to say, unless I was interviewing like Bernie Sanders, I'd say I was nervous. But, you know, good for you, Matt. I appreciate it.
I don't feel nerves that often. And so I was a little bit nervous that one.
But I feel them like every single time, but especially right now. So that's something I got to work through.
I'm trying to think of who I got nervous to interview. I think it was probably that libertarian professor. I was convinced he was going to show up. I'm like, he's a professor. He's a professor at a I can't remember what school it was. What's that guy's name again?
Was it like Block. Wayne State or something like
Walter
that?
Block. No, he was a professor at like, I mean,
it's like Ohio or someplace.
No, a legit university. Like, I'm not saying Ohio's not, but I think it was like, I feel like right. It was in the South.
And you admire his work so much.
I didn't really dig into his work as much. And, you know, it was only after that, but I just remember Michael, you know, we were talking about like how much I was like, I got to really prepare for this guy. This could be serious. And it shows up and it was like, not like that. It was not like that.
Peter is a little bit more like maybe what you were expecting. And also he has good politics.
Yes, exactly. All right. We're going to take a quick break. Don't forget, you can check out Nomi's show tomorrow. They go Tuesday through Friday every week at youtube.com/TheNomiKeyShow or twitch.tv/the_NomiKey_show. Check it out. All right. See you in the fun half. 646-257-3920.
RM for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back. 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 Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. 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 Back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back. Back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Dinner?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck! Reminder!
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
Almost says what?
Hell out of the bank. Hell out of the bank. Hell out of the bank. Hell out of the bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black. African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them!
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black.
Come on. What? Come on. What? Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy. 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 Pussy.